He will have personally crushed NATO. He will have effectively paralyzed the United States. And in so doing, he will have won the right to dictate terms on any matter, anywhere on the globe, financial, political, military, and otherwise.
The Prime Minister paused to let his words sink in.
You must not kid yourself, Senator,
he added after a moment.
These are the stakes, and they are very high. Unimaginably high.
Do you see any hope? Dayton asked.
Perhaps,
Janssen replied.
But it's a narrow path, and rapidly becoming narrower still. Go back and implore the President to send us the 82nd Airborne. Send us mechanized units. Order American battle tanks that are in storage to be taken out of mothballs and readied for service. Send fighter squadrons. Send bombers. The only hope to prevent the very real scenario I just laid out is for the U.S. and the rest of NATO to make a clear stand with us and do so immediately. Build up a force here big enough to make Luganov think twice. You don't have to match him man for man, tank for tank, plane for plane. You just have to show that NATO is ready to go toe to toe with him, using conventional forces. That's how you stop him. And that's how you make sure that all-out nuclear war isn't the only option to protect freedom on the Earth.
54. Eastern Estonia, near the Gulf of Finland, September 22nd. What stunned Marcus was that the first missile came slicing across the cloudy morning sky, low and sizzling hot, from behind them. The moment it hit its target and created a deafening explosion, Annie grabbed his arm. Seeing that, Pete shot Marcus a look deadlier than the missile. But more were coming. Almost instantly, six additional air-to-ground rockets came streaking overhead, all from behind them. The roar of the explosions and the magnitude of the resulting fireballs startled the senator and his staff. For Marcus and Pete, it brought back their years in the Corps, both their training and their tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. As Prime Minister Janssen, standing beside them, explained why his forces conducted live-fire exercises when most militaries in the world did not, helicopter gunships and attack choppers came swooping in. Each were firing 50-caliber rounds at foe Russian battle tanks constructed out of cinder blocks and wood in a long and heavily forested valley stretching out before them for several kilometers. Soon Estonian tanks and armored personnel carriers emerged from a glade to their left. They too opened fire, and when they did, the Prime Minister's words were immediately drowned out. Moments later, Black Hawk helicopters came into view from their right. Commandos began fast roping to the deck and sprinting for cover, firing American-made anti-tank missiles and tossing grenades as they did. The entire exercise lasted about an hour. Marcus found himself impressed by the professionalism of the ground troops and their air support, as well as by the intelligence briefing Janssen and his generals provided afterward. These men were deadly serious about defending their nation from the Russians, whether NATO came to help them or not. But the message they were trying to convey was painfully clear. While they would all fight to the bitter end, that end would come brutally fast, unless NATO, and especially the Americans, kept their Article 5 commitment and came to their rescue. Over a working lunch in their command bunker, Senator Dayton asked one insightful and penetrating question after another. Marcus could see he was not here to grandstand. He genuinely wanted to understand the latest intelligence that was causing the Estonians and their Baltic neighbors such angst. He also wanted to grasp as much of their game plan for resisting the Russians as they felt comfortable sharing, given that of all the senator's staff members, only Annie had a top-secret security clearance. That evening, Dayton and the team dined back in Tallinn with the U.S. ambassador to Estonia inside the embassy compound. Over dwarf herring, smoked eel, plenty of black bread and red wine, they compared notes with the ambassador, a career foreign service officer in her 50s who had served in a half-dozen other East European posts and was fluent in Russian, Polish, and German, and conversant in Estonian, on the readiness of the local forces, as well as the reluctance of NATO commanders to send more manpower and machinery. The senator also pressed the ambassador on what she made of the Russian snap exercises. She insisted this was business as usual, and one of dozens of such exercises I've seen since being posted here. She intimated that the Prime Minister's growing concern of a Russian move was slightly overheated between you and me. That said, she conceded she was genuinely worried Luganov might make a move, and soon, deeper into Ukraine. Whether he was crazy enough to go all the way for Kiev, she couldn't say. But she indicated that she had conveyed her concerns to the State Department as recently as that morning. Just before dessert came, Marcus received a phone call from Washington. He apologized for the intrusion, excused himself from the table, and stepped out of the ornate dining room into a hallway. The number was from the White House. On the other end of the line was Bill McDermott, who had recently been promoted to Deputy National Security Advisor by President Clark.
"Bill, good to hear from you," Marcus said when he'd found a bit of privacy. "Congrats on the new gig."
McDermott let loose with a tirade of profanity.
"Estonia? With the likes of Bob Dayton? Are you insane?"
Whoa, take it easy, Bill. What's gotten into you?"
"The president is preparing for a major re-election campaign, and suddenly I hear you and Pete are cavorting with the enemy?"
"We're hardly cavorting, Bill, for crying out loud. But we are taking a hard look at a real enemy. You might want to try it."
"And just what's that supposed to mean?"
"You know very well what it means," Marcus said, fighting hard to keep his voice down to avoid attracting attention from either the Estonian bodyguards or his own team members stationed up and down the hallway. "Luganov is massing forces on the border of the Baltics, but the president isn't sending more troops to create a tripwire. Nor has he made a full-throated defense of our allies here. He's hedging on Article 5. People over here are getting worried, and for good reason."
"So, Dayton's going to hit the president, again, for not being tough enough on the Russians? Give me a break. Dayton's a political dead man."
"I have to say, Bill, you sound awfully defensive for a man in a position to advise the commander-in-chief to actually get tough with the Russians."
"Just to be clear, Riker, have you formally signed on to advise a raging left-wing Democrat? One who very well could end up being the president's chief rival?"
Marcus was surprised by how personal McDermott was being, and how political as well, especially given the apolitical nature of his job. Marcus decided to de-escalate the conversation. There was no point burning an old friend, much less a man in a position so close to the president. Prime Minister Janssen had been clear that the only reason he'd agreed to meet with Dayton was to enlist him as a leading voice in the Democratic Party, to go back and talk to Clark in private, and try to persuade him to do more on a bipartisan basis to bolster NATO forces in the Baltics.
"No, I haven't," Marcus said, his voice calmer and his tone more circumspect. "Pete has, but I'm just along for the ride. The senator asked me to put together a security detail for him. Pete wanted to get me out of the house. He's worried about me. Thought a trip like this might be good for me."
Bill's tone softened.
Maybe he's right.
Maybe.
Fine. Come see me when you get back. Maybe I'll hire you instead.
Hire me? Marcus asked. What on earth for?
To keep you away from Pete Wong, for starters,
he laughed.
Take care.
You too. And with that, the line went dead. 55. Pulkova Airport, St. Petersburg, September 23rd.
The war begins in precisely 2 weeks.
Luganov said it so matter-of-factly, almost casually, as they boarded the presidential jet for the flight back to Moscow, that at first, Alek wasn't sure he had heard the man correctly.
October 7th?
Alek asked, aghast, but desperate not to show it.
But that's earlier than we'd discussed.
It's going to be delicious, my son,
Luganov continued, as he headed for the back of the plane.
NATO won't know what's hit them.
When they reached the conference room, Luganov asked Alek to shut and lock the door behind them. Alek did as he was told, as Luganov tore off his jacket and tie, loosened the top buttons of his freshly starched white shirt, and poured himself and Alek glasses of vodka from the bar behind his white leather executive chair. The president took a swig. Alek did not. It wasn't even 10 o'clock in the morning. He was growing increasingly concerned about how much his father-in-law was drinking, though this was hardly the time to say anything. There were far more urgent issues on the table.
So it's true, father. You've decided there is no way forward other than war?
Alek asked, hoping to appeal to the man as a member of his family, not his staff.
I have,
Luganov replied, opening the folder in front of him, marked classified, scanning the cover page quickly, and then sliding the entire folder to Alek.
This is the latest draft of the war plan. I've made several important changes since last week. But this is it. When I sign it, it will become final. But first, I want you to take a look at it. Tell me what I'm missing. I want to leave nothing to chance.
Alek took a deep breath, then picked up the folder with cold hands and began to read it carefully. Soon the jumbo jet was rumbling down the runway and lifting into the air. Alek kept reading. From time to time he looked up at his father-in-law, worried that he was expecting a response faster than Alek was prepared to give it. Instead, the man seemed oddly and uncharacteristically detached. He was swirling his drink in his right hand, while staring out the window at the massive city of St. Petersburg, home to more than 5 million souls, shrinking in the distance. Alek wasn't trained in the strategies or tactics of the armed services, but he had spent enough time in the company of the president and his generals to perceive that the plan in front of him was flawless. It was built around speed and the element of surprise. To the extent that the West was expecting an invasion of Ukraine, Luganov's calculus was likely spot on. An invasion of the Baltic states would utterly blindside NATO leaders. Unless they began airlifting men and materiel around the clock beginning that very night, it was highly unlikely they could prevent the Russian onslaught that was coming. Certainly not with conventional weapons. There was just one critical issue, but Alek was terrified to raise it. He had seen the Army Chief of Staff ask the same question, and the man had been immediately dismissed from the position he'd held with honor for 5 straight years, and not simply dismissed. Luganov had ordered the general arrested and sent into exile to who knew where on charges of treason. Did Alek run the same risk now? He had been asked for his opinion, and he was family. Then again, Luganov had dismissed Yulia, his wife of 34 years, without any hint of emotion or regret.
To this man, even those closest to him were evidently expendable. Still, Alec mused, wasn't it traitorous to his country, to his people, not to ask the question? Alec cleared his throat, both to get the president's attention, and by just a moment more to figure out how best to frame the most crucial conversation of his life.
From a military perspective, the plan is very impressive in every respect, Father,
he began, treading carefully.
Yet, in all honesty, I cannot shake my concerns about the intelligence informing the strategic concept.
How is that, my son?
Luganov asked, turning from the window and finishing what was left in his glass. The president did not seem defensive, so Alec took another step.
You know I have always had the highest regard for Dmitri Dmitrovich,
Alec continued, referring to FSB Chief Nimkov.
But I have to ask, is he really giving us, is he really giving you, all the facts?
To what facts are you referring?
I'm just wondering how carefully Dmitri and his team of analysts have truly studied the American president.
Andrew Clark, sniffed Luganov. Please. The man is a neophyte, a boorish fool. What more is there to know? He can't get serious legislation through the Congress. He knows nothing of NATO, nor does he care. If he did, he wouldn't be so cagey about Article 5. He'd be moving troops and tanks into the Baltics. I've discussed this at length with Dmitri Dmitrovich. Believe me, there is nothing to worry about.
But, Father, there is something here that worries me,
Alec said, leaning forward in his seat now.
I'm not disputing a single word you have just said. But I do question the psychological profile of Clark that the FSB has provided. Indeed, I worry that the profile is deeply flawed, and thus could be leading us down a very dangerous path.
Go on, Luganov said.
Clark is clearly a neophyte, that is certainly true. And he's obviously made many mistakes, some of which seem astonishing, ridiculous even. But by locking in on Clark's numerous weaknesses, his self-inflicted mistakes, and his political weakness, the FSB may be missing the man's singular strength.
Which is what?
His capacity to learn from his mistakes.
Nonsense, Luganov said. He's the most uninformed and inexperienced leader the Americans have ever elected. This opens up a door to us never unlocked at any other time since our humiliation at the collapse of the Soviet Empire.
But what the FSB is not properly weighing is that Clark was elected.
Alec calmly but firmly protested, careful to use Dmitri Nimkov as his foil, not targeting Luganov's own analysis.
The man ran arguably the most disastrous campaign in the history of any country. He foolishly steered into not one political storm, but many. Yet, he found a way to navigate to a safe harbor. He vanquished one opponent after another when no one thought he could. Admittedly, his transition was full of blunders. But in time, he corrected those as well. He hired staff that did not serve him well, to put it mildly. Yet, one by one, he has fired them and replaced them. Moreover, he chose an experienced VP and a deeply experienced and rather accomplished cabinet. And for all the rancor, even chaos, in the American political system, certainly in the media, Clark is getting things done. America hasn't imploded. The economy is growing. Millions of jobs have been created. And they're plowing tens of billions into more robust defenses.
Alec could see frustration growing in his father-in-law's eyes. He had only a few moments more to make his case without losing his job and perhaps his freedom. He had never spoken to the president like this. He could barely believe what he was hearing himself say. And yet, he found himself pressing on just a bit further.
My point is simply this. Dmitri Dmitrovich is asking you to base the entire premise of your invasion of not one, but three NATO countries on the absolute certainty that the current president of the United States is a total beginner and has no idea what he's doing, and thus would never launch a counterattack against us using conventional forces, and therefore would certainly never order a counterattack using tactical nuclear weapons, much less strategic nuclear weapons, even if you went nuclear first. Perhaps the FSB is right. But what if they are wrong? What if Andrew Clark is more unpredictable than Dmitri Dmitrovich is giving him credit for? What if Clark's ability to course-correct makes him a far cannier opponent than the FSB has adequately considered? What if the FSB's read on the American president is just wrong enough that this invasion of the Baltics leads us not to glory, but to...
To what? Luganov asked.
To ruin.
At first, Luganov glared at him. But suddenly, his entire countenance changed. He burst into laughter and poured himself another drink.
Oleg Stefanovich, what a vivid imagination you have, he roared. My son, you are not a military man. You are certainly no intelligence man, but you are a good and loyal boy, and I truly cherish your capacity to amuse me as well as advise me. Now, come. Drink up. Drink with me to the coming victory that will electrify the masses and firmly and finally re-establish Russia's place as the supreme global power.
Alec was furious, though he fought not to show it. Luganov was not only ignoring him, he was mocking him. And there was nothing Alec could do about it. He had to demonstrate his loyalty. So he grabbed the glass of vodka and forced it down with a grimace. As he did, the president signed the war plan, then picked up the secure phone back to the defense ministry. 56. The Grand Palace Hotel, Riga, Latvia, September 23rd.
You're not going to believe this.
Annie Stewart could barely contain her smile as she found the senator and the team huddled in the back corner of the pills bar, its walls covered with the mounted heads of elk and deer and other hunting trophies, in one of Riga's oldest and most elegant hotels. It was nearly midnight. Most of the patrons had turned in for the night. Even the print and cable reporters covering their trip had paid their tabs and gone to bed. But Dayton and his chief of staff were poring over the latest draft of the senator's new Russia sanctions bill they'd been working on for the last few days. Pete was returning emails. Marcus was listening to a Nats game on his iPhone. The security detail was standing post by the front and side doors. But Annie had news. "What have you got?" asked the senator.
I just got off the phone with the Kremlin,
Annie said, instinctively lowering her voice, even though the only one within earshot was the bartender, who, as they'd already found out, barely spoke English.
It's a done deal.
What is? Pete asked, struggling to appear more interested in what she had to say than how attractive she looked in her black cashmere sweater, faded blue jeans, brown boots, and Cartier watch.
Luganov, she said. He's agreed to a meeting.
You're kidding, Dayton said.
No, sir, I've been working on it all evening. That's why I missed dinner with the foreign minister.
This is tremendous, great work.
So when is it? Marcus asked.
Well, that's the thing. The only time he has to meet is tomorrow at 4:30.
Where?
In his office at the Kremlin.
Pete slapped Marcus on the back.
Wow, this is huge!
But we're supposed to be in Vilnius tomorrow, the senator protested.
I know,
Annie said. I'm supposed to have dinner with the prime minister.
It's your call, sir. But if we decline, I don't know that we'll have another opportunity.
What do you all think? Pete? I say we do it, sir, definitely. We can always reschedule with the Lithuanians.
Everyone else agreed with Pete. Everyone except Marcus.
What's the matter, Marcus? The senator asked. This was your idea, after all.
I realize that, sir. And I still support a meeting with Luganov, but I would recommend against looking too eager.
What's that supposed to mean?
Decline the invitation for tomorrow, Marcus continued. Have Annie call back and explain that you have meetings in Vilnius that cannot be changed, but you could be in Moscow the following day or the day after that.
But Annie just said Luganov isn't available for the rest of the week.
Sir, do you think it's wise to blow off a NATO ally to meet with the enemy? Is that really the message you want to send on this trip? And what if you do, and Luganov stands you up when you get there? The senator turned back to Annie. The man does have a point.
May I make a suggestion? She asked.
By all means.
Let me make a quick call to my contact in the PM's office in Vilnius and explain the situation. If they have a problem with it, then we accept Marcus's advice. But if they're okay with rescheduling the meeting, then we proceed to Moscow in the morning. The following day we can fly directly to Vilnius, and you can brief the PM on your meeting with Luganov. How's that sound?
Marcus hesitated. He still wasn't crazy about the idea. But it was the senator's trip, not his. Works for me, he said. Dayton grinned.
Me too. Good thinking. Get it done, Annie. This might be the break we've been hoping for.
The Lithuanian Prime Minister agreed. They were heading to Moscow. Dayton and his team landed at Domodedovo International Airport just after 11 a.m. on Wednesday. They checked into the Hotel Nacional a little after 1 that afternoon. Marcus insisted that they enter from the back and not let the media know where they were staying. He remembered every grisly detail of the suicide bombing that had occurred there, which he'd been briefed about when he'd done an advance trip for the VP a while back. He and his men took the senator up a service elevator to a set of suites on the 4th floor. After making sure the rooms were secure, Marcus posted one man at the main elevators and another by the service elevator. One he put downstairs in the café to keep an eye on the lobby. The rest he posted inside the doors of the senator's personal suite. None of them had been permitted to bring their weapons off the jet, but a discreet request to Nick Vinetti at the U.S. Embassy had gotten around that. Nick made sure each man on Marcus's team was given a Sig Sauer automatic pistol from the Marine Armory. Nick also loaned them several MP5 machine guns and plenty of rounds of ammunition, plus several Uzis rarely used anymore. What's more, the embassy was providing 3 armor-plated black Chevy Suburbans, drivers from the embassy motor pool, and whatever logistics the senator needed. As a prospective presidential candidate, Robert Dayton had no access to the embassy's official diplomatic resources. But since he was the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, his trip qualified as a CODEL, State Department parlance for a congressional delegation. And for a CODEL, it was Nick's responsibility as deputy chief of mission to make sure everything went smoothly and safely for Dayton and his team. The time for the Luganov meeting kept changing. When they landed, Annie was told the meeting had been moved back to 7 p.m. Upon arriving at the hotel, she was told it had been moved up to 3 p.m. Yet, as Marcus took a quick shower and changed into a suit, he received an urgent text from Annie to the team that the meeting had been postponed indefinitely. "They're playing with you, Senator," Marcus said when he arrived at Dayton's suite. "Plan for the original 4:30 time slot. If the meeting is going to happen at all, I can almost guarantee it will be then. Let's roll at 3:30 as originally planned so we have enough time to clear Kremlin security." Dayton was skeptical and visibly agitated. As it happened, however, Marcus had called it exactly right. During the brief ride to the Kremlin, Pete leaned over and whispered to his friend that his stock was definitely on the rise with the senator. Marcus nodded to confirm he'd heard, but privately, his doubts were growing about whether any of this was a good idea. They were now deep in enemy territory, and as honest and principled as Dayton might be, Marcus knew the senator was no match for Luganov, the reigning grand master of geopolitical chess. The three-vehicle American motorcade was escorted by the Moscow police's VIP unit. This thrilled Dayton's press secretary and chief of staff. After all, the images of their man entering Red Square and passing St. Basil's Cathedral, and then passing through the gates into the Kremlin itself, would look great on CNN and MSNBC that night. But Marcus's anxiety began to spike when only the lead Suburban, the one carrying Dayton, Annie, Pete, and himself, was cleared to enter, and the other two were not. Even without their security detail, Marcus had few concerns for their physical safety. Besides the White House itself, there was no government compound in the world as secure as this one. There was certainly no way President Luganov was going to allow a prominent American senator, especially such a harsh critic, to be assassinated in the heart of the Russian capital. No, Marcus's real worries were for the senator's reputation and political viability. The man was entering the lair of a wolf. He would likely re-emerge, but the question was, how damaged? 57. They were taken first to the visitor center at the Kutafya Tower. There they were met by a junior protocol officer who escorted them to the appointments desk, where they received visitor IDs and passed through metal detectors. Their possessions went through X-ray machines and WMD sniffers. Only then were they guided through Troitskaya Tower, past the arsenal and the State Kremlin Palace, and into the pale yellow building known as the Senate. Next, they were handed off to a more senior protocol officer who was waiting for them. She did not smile. She did not shake their hands. She simply greeted the senator with emotionless indifference, effectively ignored his colleagues, and took them up an elevator to the third floor. They had to stop at another security checkpoint, where they once again submitted to the protocol.
"In such times one can never be too careful," said one of the security agents, discerning the annoyance in Dayton's eyes.
It struck Marcus as an undiplomatic thing to say to a visiting U.S. senator. But he nevertheless respected the security protocols the Russians had in place, especially given the apartment bombings in Moscow years before, other more recent terrorist attacks in Moscow and various capitals throughout Europe, and of course, the attack on the White House that he had personally experienced. When they were cleared, the Americans were led to an anteroom flanked by armed security men in dark suits with ugly ties. One of the men directed them to a waiting area with nicely upholstered couches and chairs and a mahogany coffee table, where they were served tea and some light snacks. Marcus took in and memorized every detail. How many men were in the lobby and down the hall? How many CCTV cameras there were, and where they were positioned. The sound that the doors made when they electronically locked and unlocked. The number of non-security staff in the vicinity, and so forth. He had been all over the world with the president and the VP. In the process, he had become acquainted with security personnel and procedures in palaces and government office buildings of every conceivable kind. But he had never been here, to the epicenter of the Russian government, and he found himself immensely curious. The senior protocol officer informed them that the 4:30 meeting had been delayed until 5. Then 5:30. Then 6. As it turned out, it was not until nearly 7 o'clock that they were finally ushered into the president's office. Senator Dayton was furious, and Marcus braced himself for the tirade that was coming. But Alexander Ivanovich Luganov caught them all off guard by greeting them warmly and apologizing profusely for keeping them waiting. He explained that the crash of a Russian airliner near the border of Mongolia had kept him occupied for hours. He spoke only in Russian, while a 40-ish woman standing at his side served as his interpreter. Rather than sit behind his desk, Luganov met them in the center of the spacious, dark-paneled corner office. He was dressed in a charcoal-gray suit, a light-blue shirt, and a crimson silk tie, and he smiled broadly as he shook the senator's hand, while official Kremlin photographers and videographers captured the moment. Standing just a few feet away at all times was Special Agent Pavel Kovalyov, who Marcus knew was the chief of the president's security detail. Luganov gave them a brief tour of the artifacts and framed power photographs that hung on several walls. There was Luganov standing with various American presidents. There he was at several G8 summits, back before the invasion of Ukraine, when Russia was still a member. There was Luganov with the Premier of China, the dictator of North Korea, the supreme leader of Iran, and even the Prime Minister of Israel. On his shelves, he had 2 crisscrossing scimitars, gifts from the King of Saudi Arabia. He had some ancient pottery from Egypt, and an exquisitely painted ceramic bowl from India. As the charm offensive continued, Marcus studied the man he had last seen at the German Chancellery in Berlin. Back then, Luganov's hair had been sandy blonde and thinning, with just a touch of gray about the temples. Now, the gray was gone, and his hair was a dark brown. Marcus almost smiled at the notion that Luganov was coloring it, but he forced himself to remain impassive and inscrutable. Still, the hair aside, Luganov looked decidedly older and weathered to Marcus, with crow's feet at the corner of his eyes, and more wrinkles in his face and neck. The Russian had been only 61 when Marcus had seen him last, and had seemed full of vim and vigor. Now he was approaching 70, and Marcus couldn't help but notice that though he was still quite trim and broad-shouldered, he seemed somewhat stiff, and was maneuvering about the room with a slight limp in his left leg. When the tour was finished, and they were about to take their seats, Luganov pressed a button to the right side of his desk. A door opened, and an aide walked in. Marcus recognized him instantly, but maintained a poker face, and said not a word.
"Senator Dayton, I'd like you to meet my son-in-law and most trusted counselor, Alek Stefanovich Kraskin."
The two men shook hands. Then Alek greeted Pete and Annie in turn. When Alek got to Marcus, he hesitated, if only for a moment. He said nothing, but Marcus registered the look of recognition in the man's eyes. They shook hands firmly, but that was it. Neither man acknowledged that they had met before. Luganov sat down behind his desk and motioned for everyone to be seated. The interpreter retreated to a small wooden chair beside the desk. Alek sat on the other side of the desk, his notebook and pen at the ready. The senator sat in an ornate cushioned chair directly across from the president, with Annie to his right, and Pete to her right. Marcus took the last open chair to Dayton's left, and the meeting got down to business. It most certainly did not go as any of them expected. 58. Dayton wasted no time lighting into the president. Diplomatically, yet with fierce conviction, the senator charged Luganov with breaching the terms set forth in the Budapest Memorandum by violating the territorial integrity of eastern Ukraine and Crimea. Then he expressed outrage at what he called Russia's war crimes in Georgia and Syria, before launching into a brief but aggressive closing argument. I urge you, Mr. President, not to take any action the people of Russia would regret in regard to the Baltics or any other member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I am well aware that you have recently massed tens of thousands of troops, hundreds of battle tanks, and scores of bombers and fighters on the borders of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, in addition to the 100,000 troops you've put into Belarus and on the borders of Ukraine, Dayton said. You say it's a series of military exercises, but that's what you said before you invaded Georgia in 2008, and before you invaded Ukraine in 2014. I have just spent several days in Kiev and the Baltics. I have met with their political leaders and their generals. I have reviewed their forces and seen their consummate professionalism and powerful commitment to freedom and their own sovereignty. Furthermore, I would remind you that the Baltic states are proud and loyal members of NATO, and they have the full backing of the rest of the alliance. And this is why I have come, to urge you not to gamble in this neighborhood. Stop attempting to intimidate the alliance. Give no more thought to acquiring territory that is not legally, morally, or in any way rightfully yours. Do not miscalculate here, Mr. President. The stakes are much too high. Marcus found himself at once impressed and as tense as he'd ever been in a meeting between world leaders. He hadn't been certain this Iowan, known for his Midwestern nice, had the wherewithal to speak so directly to arguably the most dangerous man on the planet, and in his own office, no less. Only time would tell whether Dayton could prove to be a Churchill, but he certainly was no Chamberlain. Not today. Marcus could see the anxiety in the translator's eyes, and at that moment he doubted she had ever been required to communicate such a statement to her boss before now. Marcus glanced at Alec. The man's hand had stopped writing. An icy chill fell over the room as the senator looked the president directly in the eye. Marcus could see the man's jaw clenched as he waited for the translation.
I did not invite you here to be lectured in my own home, Senator, Luganov began, eyes narrowing when the translation was complete. That said, I will give you credit for your candor. Believe me, I have heard you rage against me and against my government's decisions over the years, from the safe confines of the Senate floor and the Senate press gallery and the Washington studios of CNN. I agreed to your request for a meeting because I wanted to see if you had the courage to say to my face what you routinely spout to the American people. Now I see you do, and I congratulate you, sir.
Mr. President, with respect, I did not come here to lecture you, the senator replied, and I most certainly did not come to be patronized by you. There is one purpose, and one purpose only, in my visit, to urge you to back your forces away from the borders of the Baltics and Ukraine, and to warn you, if I may put it so indelicately, not to risk making a miscalculation that could plunge your country, mine, and the whole of Europe into a war that would surely spin rapidly out of control. The senator paused, either for effect or for the translator to catch up. The Americans in the room braced for Luganov's reaction. But when the president spoke, he threw a curveball none of them had wargamed.
"Message received, Senator," Luganov replied,
his countenance softening and his body language relaxing.
"I intend nothing threatening in these exercises. We conduct them all the time. We will continue to do so. Your country conducts such exercises. So does the rest of NATO. After all, I believe you attended a series of live fire exercises in Estonia a few days ago. So, I say again, these are nothing out of the ordinary, nor should they be construed as menacing in the slightest. Indeed, while they were scheduled to last through the month of October, my generals and I are so pleased with how they are going that I have decided to conclude them early."
Dayton was visibly astonished. "How early?" he asked, trying to regain his composure.
"They should be wrapped up in 10 days' time, give or take a day."
"The exercises near the Baltic as well as those close to the Ukraine?"
"Yes."
"I have your word on that."
"Don't be impertinent, Senator. I'm agreeing with you that we don't want anyone to miscalculate here. I'm agreeing to stand down my forces for the time being."
"Mr. President, please understand my country's hesitancy to count upon the word coming out of the Kremlin. How does the Russian proverb go? Trust, but verify."
"Doveriyai, no proveriyai,"
Annie said, almost under her breath. At this, Luganov smiled.
"Miss Stewart, you speak Russian?" he said, in Russian.
"Da," she replied.
Luganov asked, again in Russian, how much of his side of the conversation she had understood.
"All of it,"
she replied instantly, but in English. Luganov looked impressed.
"And how precisely is my young translator here communicating my meaning?" he asked.
It struck Marcus as an odd thing to say, since the translator was almost certainly at or near the age of 50, while Annie, Pete, and himself were in their late 30s.
"She's doing an excellent job," Annie said,
looking at the woman in the corner and smiling warmly. The woman looked simultaneously grateful and mortified. The thought of being a topic of the president's conversation had to be anathema to her. But Luganov abruptly changed the subject.
"There is more I will tell you, Senator," he said.
"By all means."
"I have not made this public yet, but I will tell you all, because it will be news very soon," Luganov continued. "Tomorrow I am flying to Pyongyang to announce the conclusion of several months of secret negotiations."
"Regarding what?"
"The North Korean leader and I will sign a treaty," Luganov said. "The signing will be broadcast live around the world. I am creating a military alliance with Pyongyang. I will pledge to come to North Korea's defense, should it ever be attacked by the South, or by the U.S., or by any other force. In return, Pyongyang will completely abandon its nuclear program and turn all of its nuclear weapons, uranium, and additional nuclear materials over to me. Their nuclear reactors and laboratories will be dismantled or destroyed. What's more, I will invite international inspectors to observe and monitor the process."
Luganov stopped speaking, but the senator did not respond immediately. When he did, he congratulated the president on what he hoped would be a significant move toward true peace on the Korean Peninsula. Marcus's defenses were on full alert. He was certain Dayton was being played by the world's master manipulator. But even a blind man could see that Luganov's charms were casting their spell as intended. as surprised and impressed as Marcus had been with the senator when the meeting began. He now felt just as surprised and equally dispirited. If one of the leading Russia hawks in Washington could be so easily beguiled, then the people of the West were sitting ducks indeed. Marcus brooded over his worries for the rest of the evening. Even the catered dinner with Ambassador Tyler Reed and DCM Nick Vanetti couldn't shake Marcus's genuine fear for the people of Europe and the fate of the NATO alliance. He was all but certain Luganov was preparing to strike hard and strike soon. At which target, Ukraine or the Baltics, he could not say. Luganov's plan for a treaty with North Korea was almost certainly sheer disinformation and sleight of hand. Yet in the absence of proof, who would listen to an ex-Secret Service agent whose closest friends had diagnosed him as depressed? 59. The Hotel National, Moscow, September 25th. The phone startled Marcus awake. It was not his mobile ringing, nor the secure satellite phone he'd rented for the trip. This was the hotel phone on the nightstand beside the bed. Marcus was instantly awake and on his feet, the muscle memory reaction of years of training. He picked up the receiver even as he read the LED display on the clock radio. It was 3:37 in the morning.
"Hello? Is this Agent Riker?"
asked a man's voice on the other end of the line.
"Who's asking?" "Is this Special Agent Marcus Riker?"
the man asked again, stressing each word.
"I'm retired, but yeah, why?"
The line went dead.
Then Marcus heard two light raps, not on the door to the hallway, but on the one that connected to the adjacent suite.
"Who's there?"
Marcus asked as he walked to the closed and locked door.
"Don't you recognize my voice?"
the man said from the other side. Marcus tried to place the voice, but couldn't. It was definitely a native Russian speaker and a Muscovite, but the man was speaking too quietly for accurate identification.
"No, I don't." "Agent Riker, this is Oleg Kraskin. Please let me in. We must talk." Oleg Kraskin? Why in the world would the son-in-law of the Russian president be staying in the suite next door?
Marcus wished he had one of the Sig Sauer pistols Nick had given to his team, but there was nothing he could do about that now. When he heard two more knocks, Marcus decided to take the bait. He unplugged the lamp on the nightstand, wielded it like a club, and unlocked and slowly opened the door. He was tense, suspicious, and ready for a fight. To his astonishment, it really was Kraskin. He wore a black silk shirt, black jeans, and snakeskin boots. And he was alone. No handlers, no security.
"May I come in?"
Alec asked, his Russian accent thick, almost overpowering. Marcus looked him over for a moment, then glanced behind him to see if there was anyone else in Alec's room. Not seeing anyone, he finally nodded and stepped aside. Alec was shorter than him, though not as diminutive as Luganov, and rail-thin, almost gaunt. But he strode in with great purpose through the bedroom and into the adjoining sitting room and sat down on the couch. Marcus closed and locked the door behind Alec. He set down the lamp and followed the Russian into the sitting room.
"To what do I owe this early morning honor, Mr. Kraskin?"
Marcus asked, standing there in boxer shorts and a t-shirt.
"I don't have much time," Alec said in a whisper, "so I'll get straight to the point."
Marcus opened his hands as if to say, "The floor is all yours." Then he sat down in a chair opposite Alec.
"Agent Riker, You must promise me that whatever I share with you, you will tell no one that you heard it from me. Please, I must insist. I am putting my life in your hands by even coming to meet with you.
I'll do my best, Marcus said, but I have no idea what you're about to say.
I can give you information critical to your national security and that of your allies, but I cannot do so unless I have your word that you will protect my identity.
Was this a trap?
Marcus immediately asked himself.
Was he being set up, recorded, videotaped? How could he make such a promise without knowing answers to these and so many other questions?
Marcus glanced around the room, but Alec quickly assured him that the rooms were no longer bugged.
That all went out with the Cold War, he insisted.
Fine, Marcus said, but why come to me?
My motives are my own business.
Yet you ask me to trust you.
I do.
I don't even know you.
Believe me, Agent Riker, you will want to hear what I have to say.
Maybe so, said Marcus. But let's be honest. I could be in danger, as could the Senator, simply by you coming here.
Not as much danger as I am in,
Alec replied.
Tomorrow, or the next day, you all can leave. I cannot. But neither can I remain silent. I must tell someone. And I've chosen you. Perhaps you don't have reason to believe me. Fine. I ask you only to listen. And then go back to Washington and independently evaluate everything I tell you. If I speak the truth, perhaps you'll trust me to tell you more. But I need your word. You will never betray my identity, and I need it now.
It was not an unreasonable request. Marcus concluded. Yes, taking the meeting was a risk, but perhaps it was worth it to spend a few minutes with a man so close to the Russian president. Even if the man had come to plant disinformation, simply hearing what he had to say might prove very valuable. So, Marcus gave Alec Kraskin his word.
Perhaps you should write all this down, said Alec.
Say what you've come here to say. I will remember every word, Marcus assured him. Alec stared at Marcus for a moment, then closed his eyes. He seemed to be steeling his resolve for whatever task he had set for himself. Finally, he reopened his eyes and looked directly at Marcus again.
Very well, he began. You must understand that everything, or nearly everything, my father-in-law said to you and the senator and your team last night was a lie.
Marcus said nothing.
He's not going to pull our forces back from the border of the Baltics,
Alec continued. Why not? Marcus asked.
Because 12 days from today, on or about October 7, he's going to invade the Baltic states.
Which one?
All of them.
You're serious?
I am,
Alec said.
He'll pull our forces off the border of Ukraine, as he promised. But your president must not be deceived. He will only do so to reinforce the units he's going to send into the Baltics.
Let me get this straight, Marcus said, incredulous. You're telling me your president has decided to invade not one, but 3 NATO countries?
Yes. That's madness.
Why would he do it?
Because he can,
Alec said.
My father-in-law is convinced no one will stop him, that these nations are his for the taking. He grabbed 1/5 of Georgia, and no one did anything. He took Crimea and eastern Ukraine, and what happened? Nothing.
This is completely different, Marcus said.
Because it's NATO,
of course.
Nevertheless, he's gambling. He can strike so fast and hard that no one can stop him. And once he's got what he wants,
No one will want to risk nuclear war to take it back.
Marcus sat there, trying to make sense of it all. It's not that what Alec was saying was far-fetched, but it was surreal.